This is the second of a series of three in which we are trying to crystallize the, what I think are basic, if not the basic, underlying beliefs or tenets that have emerged from the Navigator history out of 30 years and are, we believe, biblical, and also express an inner conviction of ours, we believe prompted by the Holy Spirit, that these are things that should interpenetrate and underlie everything else we do in the Navigators. It's rather interesting, in the last couple of years, the number of people we've had come by the Glen to tell us what our job is, what we ought to be doing, and areas in which we ought to be moving. And one of the fellows in our assistance group made the observation that if we don't say too clearly sometimes what we feel our mission is, just wait till somebody comes along and tries to change it. There is an inner sense of conviction and mission that we have a job to do. I'm going to be talking more about that on Thursday as to the objectives of the Navigators, which parenthetically have been subjected to a good deal of discussion this last year particularly. And these three talks are preliminary to this, but I think they're more important than the statement of the objective. And so on Saturday, we talked about the authority and the sufficiency of the Scriptures. Now this morning, as I begin the second, I'm rather shattered, to say the least. First of all, Dr. Nida, in this sort of an incidental aside, said better in a sentence or two what's going to take me an hour. And then, lo and behold, Sam Clark, in a very simple testimony, said very effectively last night what I want to say this morning. But the facts are, I spent a long time working on this. Day and night. And I'm going to preach it. Would you all please listen? About 6 weeks ago, the assistants and I went up to Denver for about 2 days, and I preached it to them, and I ran into a snag right in the middle. Sparks flew all over the place. So I went back and began to puzzle on, what's the matter? I know there's something I've got to say here, perhaps I must not be saying it right, or else it's the wrong thing. Then later I went to Oklahoma City, so I called ahead and I asked Gene Ward to get Dr. Harold Hoyt, who is a practicing Christian psychologist, to get him out to his home. And so I preached this to them, and I ran into snags at the same place. So I came back and I worked it over again. So this is some of the results. This second belief has to do with people. Men, women, boys, girls, their worth, their value, their possibilities, and their capacities. And I'm sure that anyone who's familiar with the Navigators would know that a basic belief would have something to do along this line. Our whole concept of follow-up, man-to-man, personalized correspondence courses, our personnel board policies that have been emerging this last year, all relate to this subject of people. But precisely what is it? How do you say it? I could have saved a lot of time if I had just taken notes during this conference. But the more I've thought into it, and it's been helpful for me, it really has, because I've done some very deep thinking on this, and it's helped my own life. But the more I've thought about this, the more impressed I am with the mysteriousness of human life. In our personnel board, we had quite a hassle for a couple of sessions on personality. And what part does it play? Here is an individual who, he knows how to lead people to Christ, he's done it. He knows how to build them up in the faith, he's done it. He knows how to band men together, he's done it. He has maturity and has all the rest of these things, plus a very abrasive personality. Well, now, how far do you go? Does this disqualify a person? Can we have this kind of a person representing the Navigators? Don't we all have some personality difficulties, and it's simply a matter of degree? What is personality, anyway? Changing Times, in an article on personality tests just in April this year, said that in spite of tons of material on personality development, very little is known about it. In fact, in what little reading I have done, I discovered that there isn't very much definite on what personality is, to say nothing about how do you develop it. So we're talking about something this morning that's very mysterious, wonderful, complex, fascinating, and in many, some ways, disagreeable, and yet very precious. But I have a deep feeling, and I hope I can express this morning, that there's something basic that must be said to the navigator staff, to ourselves, along this line. That unless we do, that we could lose something. And I have an uneasy feeling that it's in this realm that we could miss out. And there, and also I have discovered, as I've thought into this, I really need a revival in my own heart in this particular thought. I've entitled this simply, and maybe you can help me with the title. I've used the dictionary and all the rest, but I've simply entitled this basic belief, The Significance of Every Individual. The Significance of Every Individual. Phillips Brooks says, or said, if we could see how precious the human soul is as Christ saw it, our ministry would approach the effectiveness of Christ. If we could see the preciousness of the human soul. And yet today it seems more difficult than ever to keep a sense of the value of the individual. He's lost in the population explosion. He's lost in the communist domination of state. He's lost as the cog in the machine of big industry. He's even the silent partner, though he may be home in the evening, but in front of the TV set, totally impersonalized. He's suppressed as being inferior. And yet there is something inside of all of us that just cries out for recognition. Because we heard this on Saturday. He longs for life to have meaning, purpose, significance. And when the significance is stifled, there's an inner smoldering and an increasing pressure to revolt. Until finally there's an explosion. To me it's a very significant thing that the revolution or the insurrection there against communism in Hungary a few years back was by young people who had been raised from infancy up to that age. Which showed again the failure of that whole philosophy that denies the significance of an individual. In our civil rights movements today, there's something down inside that has to be significant. Now, as I think of this in the place of the individual and the navigators historically, I think that here we certainly find it outstandingly exemplified in Doss Trotman's life. And early in his Christian life, one of the two books that outside the Bible that probably meant most to him that helped shape his thinking was Power Through Prayer by E.M. Bounds. Most of you have read this, but let me read, and I think it's important enough for me to take time just to read a couple of paragraphs from the opening chapter, which I've heard him refer to time and time again, which shaped his thinking. We are constantly on a stretch, if not on a strain, to devise new methods, new plans, new organizations to advance the church and secure enlargement and efficiency for the gospel. This trend of the day has a tendency to lose sight of the man or sink the man in the plan or organization. God's plan is to make much of the man, far more of him than of anything else. Men are God's method. The church is looking for better methods, but God is looking for better men. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. The dispensation that heralded and prepared the way for Christ was bound up in that man. John. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The world's salvation comes out of that cradled son. When Paul appeals to the personal character of the men who rooted the gospel in the world, he solves the mystery of their success. The glory and efficiency of the gospel is staked on the men who proclaim it. When God declares that the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him, he declares the necessity of men and his dependence on them as a channel through which to exert his power upon the world. I'll never forget getting the letter from a young fellow in South Africa
who told us how he felt that he was called to work with the Navigators. And after corresponding with him for a couple of years, I took a trip all the way from Nairobi. In fact, Ed Rice and I went together all the way down to South Africa to see this fellow, Peter Church. And to find out that Doss was down there just for one trip, and here's this young fellow in seminary that he singled out and invested this time in, and everything that Doss had invested in that young fellow, he'd been putting into practice that he knew. The individual. And I don't think I need to take time just to delineate all the way along the life of Doss Trotman, the importance of the man, the individual. Jim Downing told me he was downtown here recently, and he was talking with a couple of men who knew Doss. And this one fellow said, you know, the thing that struck me about this man was that he apparently felt that I was important. This characterized his life. Why did Billy Graham ask for Doss to help with the follow-up? Well, here is a person who is engaged in mass evangelism. Why did he want Doss? I think it's because of his concern for every individual. I was talking with Billy Graham last fall in Los Angeles after the L.A. Crusade. He said, you know, I think that maybe the Navigators have been raised up by God, among other things, to provide workers for our association. Well, I thought, yeah, Pyatt, Riggs, Lochner, Clark, and Pete George, maybe so. And Charlie and I talked about this later. Why is it they keep coming to us for people to help train the counselors? Well, I think they've had anywhere at that time, I think they had 30 or 40 seminary students there on a special just to be there for the whole week. Why didn't they want them? There are people who could bring the lectures. And in fact, Flowchart Root, you know Bob Root, we call him Flowchart Root. He has all these things organized in books, and anybody could read would know the procedure that's to be followed. But there's something else that they want, and that they want in Charlie Riggs and in Dan Pyatt, and that is the spirit of the thing, the heart of the thing, the conviction of the importance of going to any lengths to help that particular given individual. But it's not just the idea of the individual, and Jim Downing helped me on this, as we talked about the other day. It's the one out of the crowd. Here's Jesus coming into the city, and there are people crowded on all sides, and he looks up and says, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house today. The one out of the crowd. Here's the London Crusade. 34,000 people go forward. How in the world are you going to give any kind of individual time to 34,000 people? And to a lot of us, and maybe most of us, we get so involved with sort of the blob, the mixture, the mass, but not so with Doss. He zeroed in on one or two, an individual out of the crowd. One of them was Bob Howarth. The one out of the crowd. And I think that this is one of the things that made Doss Trotman a recruiter. It wasn't the individual as opposed to the crowd, but out of the crowd for this one and for that one. Dan Pyatt. I think that you know that Dan Pyatt is really a recruiter of men. Everywhere you go, you find some people that Dan Pyatt has laid hold of. And he's done a lot of his recruiting, in fact, most of it between 12 midnight and 2 a.m. But what he's done, he zeroes in on one out of the crowd. This is what I mean by an individual. Paul goes to Europe. And when he first gets there in Acts 16, verses 13 to 14, it says, then on the Sabbath we went out of the city by a riverside, where prayer was wont to be made. And we sat down and spake unto the women which resorted thither. And a certain woman named Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, which worshipped God, heard us, whose heart the Lord opened. Then she attended unto the things which were spoken of Paul. Come over to Europe and help us. Then out of all of these, there's this little prayer meeting. And out of all the prayer meeting, there was Lydia. And I think of Doss again on his trip around the world. He comes through Holland. And all the people that he met and all the meetings that were set up, he saw in one person, Ian Carson, a navigator, Lydia, for Europe. The one out of the crowd. the individual. As it says in Ezekiel 22:30, and I sought for a man among them. Psalm 1, blessed is the man. Spurgeon says this idea is the one out of a thousand. But now my question is this idea a basic belief, or is it beyond that, is it a conviction in our hearts today of the significance, the value, the worth of an individual? A few years ago, I related to you how in the Chattanooga Crusade, I was responsible for the counseling and the follow-up, and Doss came down to visit me, just to see how I was getting along. One day after lunch, I went up to his room, and we're just resting a bit, and he was on one bed and I on the other. And I said, you know, Doss, in the midst of all these large classes and so many people come forward in this mass work, it's easy to lose the vision that we have of the, I forget what words I use, but the idea of concentrating on an individual. And he said, well, Sonny, I sometimes wonder if you have that vision. Well, now, I'd worked with him for 11 years. He said, but when the time comes when you think about it morning, noon, and night, you talk it, you think it, you eat it, you sleep it, and this is a consuming drive, then you have it. I wondered, you know, we've said in times past we haven't gotten too much by way of individualized results from Graham Crusades. Maybe it's because it's been our attitude, our outlook. Or that maybe it's the correspondence courses that have kept us from zeroing in. Maybe that isn't it at all. Maybe it's something deeper than this. Well, why do I believe it? Do you believe this morning in the importance of individual personal attention? Do you believe in the importance of man to man? Why, sure, because we're supposed to. That's the navigator image. And what's more, we say it's the most practical way of getting the job done. Well, I am convinced that if that's the reason, it'll never survive. We've got to have a much deeper sense of something that goes life deep than just the fact that that's our image or that it's the most practical way of getting the job done. And if it's only just a practical way that that's the most effective, it'll not become a consuming passion that will survive all kinds of pressures to move us away from it. So it's got to go deeper. So therefore, I'd like to talk a little bit about the basis of this belief, that maybe the basis of the basic belief of the significance of every individual. And there are two things I want to bring up. First is that every person is significant to God. The worth of an individual. That every person has intrinsic value built in as an entity. That they are significant, that they are valuable, they are worth something to God. And this is absolute. This is a fact. Let's turn back for a moment to Genesis, the first chapter. This is where we begin. Let's look together, shall we? Genesis chapter 1. Verses 26 to 28. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God created man in his own image. The very nature of God, personality, the power of abstract thought, moral being, able to choose, emotions, a spiritual nature. And not only that, but these powers go on forever and develop. Therefore, one person is worth more than all the irrational creatures all put together. If this entire earth, with all the irrational creatures upon it, just went poof like that and was gone, obliterated, that would be less of a loss than if one soul were blotted out. You see, we have the capacity for the image, the likeness of God. Jesus said, "Doesn't our Heavenly Father see one sparrow when it falls?" And as it puts it in the Revised, "You are more worth, you are more value than flocks of sparrows." So we're significant by virtue of the original creation. Not only that, but every individual is significant by virtue of the tremendous cost to redeem him. God thought he was worthwhile for Jesus Christ to come to earth and to take his sins, die in his place on the cross. And that every person was significant enough to be redeemed not just with corruptible things such as silver and gold, which seem so valuable to us but are insignificant compared to the value of a person, but rather with the blood of Jesus Christ. Every person is significant to God. There are a lot of scriptures, of course. It leaps at you all through the Bible, doesn't it? For instance, take the story here that Jesus tells, the parables in Luke 15. We have, first of all, the lost sheep. And he concludes by saying, "I say unto you that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repents." And then he makes the application to the lost coin in verse 10. "Likewise, I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth." So every individual is significant. Like original creation, by redemption at infinite cost. Not only that, but God, but because of sanctification. God has never given up his original objective, has it? He made in the image, this image was marred, but what is he doing today? Well, let's take 2 Corinthians 3:18, for instance. We all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image. 2 Peter 1:4, that by these ye might be partakers of the divine nature. And other scriptures. In fact, someday, he's going to make us just like Christ. 1 John 3:2. And then as I was checking this over with Dr. Nida the other day, he pointed out to me that even the institutions of God are for men as individuals. That the Roman Catholic Church, man exists for the sake of the church. But in the Protestant Church, the church exists to reach man. Man was not made for Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man. Man is the focal point. Therefore, every individual is significant, has worth, is valuable. And we need a vision of the value or the worth of a person just for himself, for what he is, for what God thinks of him. And that no one, therefore, shall escape our concern, be he ignorant or brilliant, be he a child or an old person, be he Greek or barbarian, be an outcast or a Brahmin, that every individual will be significant to us and worthy of our attention. And that it is our concern and our desire to play our part that every life should have meaning and purpose. What about the moron? What about the spastic? Is there any significance in that life? There ought to be significance and meaning to somebody, to every life, to every life. And it seems to me that we have to have this sort of a broad background of the significance of every individual before we can have the healthy concern that we need for the one individual out of the crowd. There can be something that can be self-centered, and it can be, I'll get into this a little later, but it has its weaknesses if I'm simply concerned an individual as a cog, as a means to get something done, or as a means to accomplishing my ministry. It has to be far more basic than this. We are concerned about individuals because of what God has made them and what they mean to Him. Every individual. Every individual. Now that's absolute. But then there's also a person can become significant in the sense of their possibilities as a channel of divine blessing. Now this is relative. This is contingent on knowledge, capacity, inheritance, cultural background, and I think above all else on the yieldedness and responsiveness to God. First, a person is significant by what they are, but also significant as a channel by virtue of what they can become. Now, back in Genesis, the first chapter that we read, he was made in the image of God, but he was also told to rule over the earth, have dominion. He was to be a channel of blessing. Eden was not to be a niche, a little recluse, a little resort, a little place in which he could just live happily ever after. But it was to be his headquarters, out from which he was to be a channel of blessing to subdue the earth. And God today still wants to use man as a channel. Isn't that what Romans 8 points out? That in some way that God has wrapped up in man a channel of blessing, even in redemption to all creation. But also to other men. Well, let's take Abraham, for instance. Genesis 12:3. You remember, he told him to get out of his country. I'll make of thee a great nation, and I'll bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. A channel of blessing for all the families of the earth. To me, one of the most thrilling verses in the Bible is John 1:6 that we referred to a moment ago. There was a man sent from God. When you stop and think about that for a moment, God, the great infinite God, who created all these universes, he stretched them out, sent a man whose name was John. And during those 2 months when I have acquired this term, Warren Sandy, private citizen, all I asked God for was just to call me by name, that's all. I wanted to know he was talking to me, Lauren Sandy, not the president of the Navigators, not just in general, but me. There was a man sent from God. Oh, do you remember when Cornelius had his dream over here in Acts 10? Here was this man whose prayers had come up as a memorial before God. The angel appeared to him in Acts 10, verses 5 and 6. And he said, now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon, whose surname is Peter. He lodges with one Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the seaside. He shall tell thee what thou oughtest to do. Now, if God could send an angel with specific enough instructions for Cornelius to find Peter, could he not have also had that angel tell him the news he needed to know? Of course he could. But God has chosen to use men as a channel. And so he sent Cornelius to Peter. And of course the great chapter, or one of the great chapters on follow-up, 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Verses 5 and 6, I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So So that neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase, and yet he uses men as a channel. And so because of the possibilities of an individual as a channel of blessing, God goes to great pains to purify, perfect his servant as a vessel fit for the master's use. He considers it worthwhile to work on him, to put him in the fire, to put him under the hammer and under the file. And even if Jesus himself, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. And God is relentless in pursuing a person to develop him and mature him and make him a channel. Take Jacob. And one of the great lessons of Jacob's life is that no failure is final. He was perhaps 90 years old when the angel wrestled with him and changed his name from Jacob to Israel, Prince with God. There's quite a lesson in there. I'll make a little application on that a little later, too. Well, this, then, is the basis for the belief, this number two, the significance of an individual, that every individual is significant for what he is. Regardless of birth or capacities, his intrinsic value to God for what he made him, for the price that was paid for him, and so on. But also, then, and that's absolute, but a relative thing, but what he can become as a Christ-centered, Spirit-filled Christian, as a channel of blessing. Therefore, he's worth recruiting, he's worth developing. Now, there are some questions that have been raised as I've talked along on this. Is it the individual as opposed to the crowd? Is it either or? And it's astounding to me, as I have talked over various things, these various ideas with various people, how we fall into the trap of either or. I overheard a little conversation this morning that one of the basic problems was either or. As we talked about some philosophy, it isn't. It's both and. It's the individual out of the crowd and back to the crowd. Take the woman at the well. Jesus talked to her. She went back into the town, and the whole town, well, a good number of them, came flocking out to hear. And also, we must be universal, as I pointed out a moment ago, not partial. We must be persuaded, I'm convinced, of the significance of every individual. The Savior was. Somebody called my house the other day when I was thinking about this, and they were asking for me. And our youngest, Judy, answered the phone. And I didn't know until a little later they're talking to me, but this person, I won't name them, but took quite a little time to converse with that little girl. I thought to myself, there's another illustration. That little girl is significant. This is characteristic of this person's life. What would I have done? Hello, is your dad there? No, he had just a minute for a little 9-year-old girl. Now, that's the kind of a thing I wanted. The significance of everyone. Also, I think we need a conviction of the significance of every individual and their intrinsic worth, because we look on the outward appearance and God looks on the heart. And we're not too clever at picking them out. I'm not, anyway. Because if I know people that are being greatly used today, that if they went through our personnel board, they probably wouldn't have made it. Yet God picked them out. But then, while we have a conviction of the significance of everyone, this must be universal, it must be broad, yet we have to remember that each individual is original, unlike anybody else. And, you know, it's easy for us to be really concerned about the whole world in general, as sort of a blob or a mass out there, and not really concerned for John Jones right there. Our real test of the concern for the world and our value of this and our real estimate of the significance of people, I think, is put to the test by whether or not we will give time to the one out of the crowd. Or we can theorize about the mass and all the rest, but not involve ourselves in any part of it. And you can't meet the needs of a group till you can meet the needs of one. And you can't be everywhere, so you start where you are. Jesus said, I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Someone says, well, on what basis do you pick them? I think I'm going to skip that one. I have something else I want to say first. We really hassle this one. Okay, on what basis do you decide who that individual is? Now, I will go into this just a moment. What made the difference in the Garden of Eden? Now, God intended to use man as a channel. What happened? Sin came in. What made the difference? Was it his capacities or was it his attitude? Did Adam's relative value as a channel hinge primarily on his obedience and dependence, his response to God? Why were Peter and John used and the rich young ruler was not? Do you think that Peter and John had something about them and just as men that made them preferable? What about in Luke 9, where the man said, I'll follow you, and Jesus, he said, let me go first bury my father. And Jesus said, let the dead bury the dead. And you remember who was in the company of Jesus at that time when this particular individual was invited to follow him and he used this excuse? James and John. And they're listening to this conversation. And if you look back earlier, James and John had been confronted with the very same thing. And going on from thence, he saw other two brethren. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in a ship with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and he called them. And immediately they left the ship and their father and followed him. What made the difference? Was it not in their responsiveness? What singled Lydia out of the crowd whose heart God had opened? What does 2 Chronicles 16:9 say? The eyes of the Lord went to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong. Show who strong? Himself strong. In the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. What is the prime ability? It's availability. And Doss used to love to say, and you heard him time and time again to say, that God can do more with one man, 100% yielded, than he can with 90. Or rather, one man who's 100% yielded and 100 who are only 90% yielded. Now, there are other problems, I know. Do I give equal time to everybody? How do I come to the place where this concept becomes more than a belief? Do they have the same potential if they have the same dedication? No, of course not. But here are some things I wonder about. Do I consider every individual significant because of what he is, or as a means to an end, to my program, to my little bailiwick, to my little kingdom, to my little report? Do I see him as only one piece broken off the mass and sort of impersonalized, or do I see each one as something original, something new, unlike all others? And worth more than the entire world all by itself. Am I convinced enough of the significance of every individual to be the good shepherd of Ezekiel 34? Where he says, woe be to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? You eat the fat and clothe you with the wool. You kill them that are fed, but you feed not the flock. The diseased have you not strengthened. Neither have you healed that which was sick. Neither have you bound up that which was broken. Neither have you brought again that which was driven away. Neither have you sought that which was lost. But with force and with cruelty have you ruled them, and they were scattered because there is no shepherd. I'm spoiled. I work with the cream of the crop, so to speak. How much time do I get involved with the people who are diseased? What's here? It's the sick. Another thought. And because of this, do I consider an individual, one person, more important than the Navigator organization or its reputation? couple of years ago, a couple of fellows flew back from an area to report to us about our area man and telling us that we ought to move him out of the area because he was really messing up things for us. At that time, Bob Foster was our area director, and he said to me, "Well, Lorne, what's more important, that man or the Navigator reputation?" That man. You read in the Dear Gang, and I reported the other day that Paul Lilienberg had resigned. Paul has been accused, how much degree on this, I don't know, but of indiscretion. I talked with Paul in New York. I said, "Why did you resign?" He said, I resigned because I didn't want to cause any embarrassment to the Navigators, even though I'm not guilty in this. I said, "Paul, you are more important to us than the Navigator reputation in Sweden." I said, "Now, wait just a minute. Isn't the Navigator reputation more important?" I said, "No, it isn't." Well, he wept. How significant is an individual? How much will I stick with him? How valuable? What potential? Even when it's dark. Now, I know what goes through people's minds. Yeah. "Well, man, we're going to get a whole house full of problems in our own." Well, I understand this. And the pitfalls. And, you know, we've talked about these things in time gone by. But I'm talking now about what's down in here. Another question that comes to me along this subject is, do I have too restricted a vision of the possibilities of an individual as a channel through which God can bring blessing to man? Do I have a vision of people not for what they are, but for what they can be? In John 1:41, Jesus looked at Peter, 1:42, and he said, "Thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas," which is by interpretation a stone. You are a wishy-washy, a moral coward, but you're going to be a rock, steady, stable. I take a look at one of my children. And in my mind's eye, and in your mind's eye of your children, you not only see them for what they are, but for what they can be. What you envision them when they're 19, when they're 20, when they're 25, when they have homes of their own. Well, as I look at a fellow, or I look at a girl, or I look at somebody on the Glen, or somebody that you've reached on the campus, do I have too restricted a vision of the possibilities? Does my own vision and attitude help restrict him? Take the problem of categorizing. I've heard it said, "Well, he'll never amount to much." Or, "This man will always be in this kind of a category." And if that's communicated to him, you know what will happen? He's very likely to remain in that category. And I wonder if that's right. Because who knows what new burst of life may just transform that fellow tomorrow. On the way out, coming back from the East, I read an article by Menninger, the health clinic, pointing out that he feels that the very name-calling of various mental disturbances in itself helps to make that mental disturbance fixed. They say, "Well, you're a schizophrenic." Well, I guess that's it. Now on life, they're schizophrenic. And by naming and labeling them, they restrict and confine and sort of fix that thing. I wonder if in our attitude and maybe lack of vision of the possibilities of what God can do, we are guilty of this very thing. A person is not just fixed, but they are a potential. They are a development. They are a plan. And our business is not to decide what that limit is, but to get in and help and develop and build and pray and see how what God will do with them. But I do think that we can be guilty of this. Are we hindering, and along with this, are we hindering or helping people by the incredible power of suggestion? You say, "Well, you say to you a child, well, you can't sing. Well, you just don't seem to have music." That could very well stifle that from then on. It's just like saying to giving the impression that, "Well, that child's a liar, you can't be trusted," and you can make a liar out of him. And it seems like we can say, "Well, he can't do this, and she probably never amounts any more than that," and so on. And the incredible power of suggestion just stymies it right there. But why instead of the can't, why not the can? I can do all things through Jesus Christ who strengthens me. If there's anything I learned from Doss, among other things, I learned this. It's I can, not I can't. Now, I know there are capacities, and if you overdo these, you're going to, and get it way beyond, there's going to be frustration. But it seems to me that the error is made most of the time on an inadequate view of the possibilities, rather than extending too far. Someone says, well, but that's not my gift. All right, then what is your gift? Okay, what is it? Are you using that gift? Are we stirring up the gift that's in thee? Are we limiting? Do we have too restricted a vision of the possibilities of a person? What about David's mighty man? What were they like when they started out? 1 Samuel 22:2, what? They were in debt. They were discontented. They were distressed. And those men were transformed into the mighty men that David had. When Jim Downing comes into my office, or Rod Sargent, what it has to do with either spending money or raising it, what do I see? Do I have dollar signs before my eyes? Or do I think of them as people for themselves and their concerns, and Jim and his wife and his family and so on? Or here's a pastor, and here comes the Sunday school superintendent. What pops into his mind, first of all? How good the report is. Have we increased last Sunday over the Sunday before? And I have been in places and sat down and talked with the Sunday school superintendent and found out that no one had ever talked to him about the biggest burden on his heart. This is what I mean when I say that are we interested in people as a means to our ends, or because of a conviction of their worth to God and their possibilities to God as a channel of blessing? Leroy was telling you about Scotty. Scotty was the fellow that got Leroy underway. And Leroy felt that Scotty was interested in him just because he was Leroy. Not as a means to some end that Scotty had in mind, but that he, Leroy, in himself, is significant and valuable, worth something. Now, I've asked some questions here about what is my outlook, what is my attitude. Now, another one I want to ask is, do I really trust God for people then? Do I trust God for people? We have the idea that the way that the supreme test of faith is to trust God for food and clothing, rent, and so on. And yet God miraculously fed the children of Israel for 40 years, kept them in clothes, miraculously, and the reason they were in the wilderness is because they lacked faith. And Doss Trotman used to say that the greatest test of faith he felt was to trust God for people. Perhaps you have read in Hudson Taylor's book how he, in England, went down on the beach and wrestled for a long time with this one point. I trusted God for myself, but can I trust God for 25 workers? Can I trust God for people? Jesus trusted him. Which leads me to the next question. Because of my trust in God for people, do I put confidence in people? About a year or two ago, coming back from California on the train, not that anybody ever wanted, but just for my own sake, I just made a little outline of my life, just for a little autobiography. And I noticed particularly, I listed the people who have meant the most to me. And among those, of course, my parents. And as I looked down this list of people and analyzed and thought, now, why did I appreciate them? There was one thing that just leaped out at me in every individual, every single case. Above all else, as I look back, the thing that helped me was that they gave me the impression that they trusted me. They had confidence in me. A coach in high school. My first grade teacher, Doss. My own parents. They gave me to feel that they trusted me. They had confidence in me. And I can recall many a time that a situation came up that I just would, and I could have, but I just wouldn't betray that confidence. And you know, we have, all of us, we have an immense need, every one of us, that other people trust us. And there's nothing so disheartening, is there, as a feeling that we're not trusted. We want to be, we just desperately want to be trusted and have someone to put confidence in us. And take the matter of a child. When I do all the deciding, even for his good, or someone else, be it a child or an adult, I am showing him that I do not trust his judgment. And this sows a lack of self-confidence. It makes him weak, incapable of decision, and it hinders his development. And I believe that we can hinder the development of people with whom we're working by failing to trust them. Put confidence in them. But how do you have this confidence? I think you have to get back to the way God looks at it. The intrinsic value of worth, the path of a person to God, the possibilities from God's point of view. I think it's something that God will plant in our hearts, but it's very important. Another question I ask myself, is my vision of the worth and possibilities of an individual so shallow that I give up far too soon? Remember Jesus talked about the 99, and he said he'll leave the 99 and he'll go out and he will seek. And then it's very interesting to notice, it goes on and says, until he find it. He leaves them, he goes out, and he seeks until he find it. That's persistence, isn't it? We had a fellow in the Navigators who got involved in immorality. He was very repentant about this. And then he had a couple of years, a real victory over this, and Doss felt free to send him overseas. He got overseas, and after a while, this cropped up again, and again he got into trouble. So Doss had to bring him home, but he stuck with him. This fellow today is having a very useful ministry in a certain denomination. And just a few years ago, I was leaving the Glen to make a plane, and he drove on the Glen. I hadn't seen him for a long time. And right down here where the greenhouse road meets the main road on the way out, we had a conversation through car windows. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, Lorne, he said, I don't know where I would be today if Doss had given up on me. And he said, one thing I want to say to you. He says, don't give up on fellas too soon. Don't give up on them too soon. Do I give up too soon? Now, I know there are factors here. Well, when do you? But I'm going to suggest to you that the decision on how far to pursue. Now, Jesus didn't give time to everybody. You take the rich young ruler, he put it to him very clearly, and he went away sad, but Jesus didn't chase after him. There's no record that he did. So responsiveness is a key, I think, to determining this. You remember when Jesus was pressed on by the crowd? They're just flocking on all sides, and he said, somebody touch me. His disciples sort of thought, well, of course, what do you mean? Why, yes. What do you mean somebody touched you? You've pressed him all aside. No. There was somebody touched him with the touch of faith. And he found this woman. And if we can be sensitive to the leadership of the Spirit of God, to sense out of the crowd the touch of faith, the touch of responsiveness, and then when we find this, we never give up. Now, another question is, do I go deep enough? And this is something I think we really need to consider here in our whole structure of Navigators. You see, one of the first things that a new Christian likes to do, they like to be like so-and-so. They want to be a successful, useful, fruitful Christian. So they look at the thing that this person does and think that if I do that, then I'll be like them. And they're dealing with the externals, the peripheral, and not the central. And they think by doing this and doing that and doing the other, I'll be like them in a sort of a do-it-yourself kit. No, it isn't that at all. It's the inside out. People have asked me, do you start on the outside of the wheel and go in, or the inside and go out? Well, of course, it's the inside out. And you use the word in prayer as it's with Christ. But there must be an inside out thing. Or you take our working, quote, working with an individual. I fear that sometimes we sit down and the first thing we're concerned about is to get him to do certain things. We want to shape him into something that we have a mental picture. And we don't get down inside. I suggested the other day that maybe more important than even the method or procedure of scripture memory or a quiet time is just to sit down and to share the word and to pray together. Because you can get these externals and miss something inside. Oh, you want to counsel someone, and a person walks into my office and they have a problem. So we follow this method. First, we assess the situation. We get all the facts and we lay them out. Then we define the problem. Then from the definition of the problem, we come up with 3 or 4 or 5 alternatives, solutions. Then together we pick a solution. He's going to go out and put that into practice. And that can be just as cold as ice. Suppose that same person comes in, they sit down in my office, and they tell me about the situation, and I say, you know, that's interesting. I went through something like that myself about 5 years ago. And for me, it looked like I saw everything through dark glasses. And they say, yeah, that was me too. Yeah, that's the way it is with me. And I say, well, not only did it look like I with dark glasses, but with magnifying glasses at that, everything looked worse. Yeah, that's the way it is with me. And you know, that person could go out of there without a piece of advice, without a solution as such, but helped a great deal more. Because we made contact as a person on a deeper level from the inside out. And this is why I think that this matter of an individual and his significance, his worth, his possibilities must get hold of us. I was reading a sermon not long ago by Helmut Thielicke of Germany, who today preaches to probably larger audiences than any other minister in West Germany. And I copied here something from one of his sermons, and he brings this out about parents and children and the application of this very thing, about going deep enough. What is wrong with the kind of parental love that concentrates wholly on providing food and drink and clothes and education, perhaps making great sacrifices to do so, and never gives the remotest thought to what is going on in the mind and soul of a teenage boy or girl apart from these things? Then he said that a young man, before taking his young life, wrote to him, Dr. Thielicke, and said, you are the only one whom I'm telling what I intend to do. He said, you can tell my parents. They will be thunderstruck. They never knew me despite all their care for me. They think I'm a real sunny boy when I fall with gusto into my favorite food, which my mother prepares so lovingly. They think they have fed me, but I'm starved. They make a home for me, but I was cold and homeless. With that little child or that young fellow or girl that runs around your home and mine, we provide for them. Do we know what's going on down inside? And consequently, am I building into that life wood, hay, and stubble? Or gold, silver, and precious stones? Am I preparing them to meet life with its power of sin, suffering, and death? Am I bringing them into contact with Christ himself who will help them through these trials? How deep am I going? Now let me make it a little more practical, a little closer to home still. What about the partner that you sleep in the same bed with? We can go on month in, month out, dealing with the finances of the home and all the externals, and wake up sometime to find out that we didn't know what was going on down deep inside. And Dr. Tournier says in his book, Escape from Loneliness, it's our secrets that separate us, that make us even more lonely. And as I think of it, what about the value of a soul? The infinite worth to God and the possibilities of the partner to whom you're married. and of those kids that God has entrusted to our home. And look at that little one. Did that life have meaning? How valuable is Daniel Palmer Clark today? If this whole world, with all of its irrational creatures and its gold and silver, went poof, be less of a loss than to lose that little fellow, Daniel Palmer Clark. So let's let this thing begin at home. Then I have another question to ask. Significance of an individual. Are we superficial in our judgments concerning people? Now there's a lot of talk about what kind are we looking for, the sharp, the multi-talented, the cream of the crop. Because I have a standard answer to people who say, you navigators, you recruit them from all over, you bring them to the glen, which are the best you can find the areas, and you pick the cream of the crop, and you bring them into the staff. And I just say, well, just look at us. Do you think we got the cream of the crop? You're right. That takes care of that. But what kind are we looking for, primarily? Now, capacities are important. But let me ask you primarily, is it extraordinary talents or extraordinary dedication? Is it ability primarily or availability? I've done a lot of research on this and talked with one person and another. So, now, what kind of a list of requisites should we have? What should we follow on the personnel board? Then I come over here to 1 Timothy 3, and let's see what God says about a bishop. If anyone aspires to the office of a bishop, he desires a noble task. Now, what is supposed to look for in a bishop? What is he supposed to be like? The leader now in a church. Well, he's to be above reproach. Has to do with his conduct. Married only once. Temperate. Sensible. Dignified. Hospitable. Most of these have to do with conduct. Apt teacher. Now, here's a capacity or a capability. No drunkard. Not violent, but gentle. Not quarrelsome. No lover of money. We talked about in the personnel board, shouldn't we talk about somebody and say, all right, let's run down the list. Does he love money? Is he quarrelsome? Is he hospitable? What do we think of first? Now, what are his capabilities? What are his capacities? Not that they aren't important. And not that they don't have their place. But we'll go on a little more. He must manage his own household well. So maybe we better get out and we'll send somebody to live in our home for a week before we decide whether or not they ought to be on the staff. But how often does this ever come up in the list of requisites? For if a man does not know how to manage his own, or keeping his children submissive and respectful in every way. I don't know if we've ever disqualified anybody because the kids are out of control. But for leadership, it would. Well, I wonder this. Suppose instead of some of these other checklists, and we were talking about and trying to evaluate somebody, suppose we just took the Beatitudes. And we just went right down the list and we said, is he poor in spirit? Has he come to the place where he really realizes that without Christ he can do nothing? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Because if he hasn't come to this lesson, he hasn't learned the heart of the whole thing. What does he know of John 15:5? The whole 15th chapter of John, if he doesn't know something about this first beatitude. Or blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Is he tenderhearted? Is he concerned for his own sin, the sins of the world? Is he sensitive? Or is he meek? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Is he patient under injuries? What's his response when he is mistreated, even if the people are wrong? To say nothing about when he feels mistreated when they're right. Does he hunger and thirst after righteousness? My question is, on what basis? Are we looking at it from God's point of view? Are we indeed using the Scripture as our basis of selection? Well, this is number two, the significance of an individual. Do I really believe in the worth of a human soul just for itself because of what God made it, what He's done for it, and what His concern for it? And the possibilities of an individual as a channel of divine blessing? And have that really built into me and enough to pour my life into just one out of the crowd? And these other questions are simply to stimulate us and see how they apply to all phases, the very heart of our work. Okay, let's pause for a word of prayer. Father, I do pray that by the power of the Holy Spirit, taking the Word and enlightening us and enlarging our vision and clarifying it of the value of a human soul, this worth, and also these possibilities as a channel of blessing through divine power. Lord, I want this to be a real thing in my own life that will manifest itself in my family, my co-laborers, and the ministry to which You have called us. In Jesus' name, amen.